Rothenberg, Judge Larkin, Judge Smith, the Honorable John R. Rothenberg presiding.
You may be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The first matter on our calendar is Larson et al. Versus Cross et al. Council will each have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time. As you approach the podium, give us your name and the party you parties you represent so that we've got that for the recording. The podium is adjustable. It looks like it's a little high right now. There's a little toggle switch down and to your right, I believe, and you can adjust it to suit your own preference. With that, appellant's counsel may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Scott Flaherty with the law firm of Briggs & Morgan for appellants James Larson and Therese Ross Larson. The district court committed three reversible errors. First, by holding that res judicata is triggered by a dismissal without prejudice. Second, by failing to treat as true a supporting affidavit, insisting instead that it be corroborated. And three, ignoring the plain language of the grandparent visitation statute. The first two issues go to the custody determination, and the third issue goes to the visitation. The res judicata issue is most straightforward. A dismissal without prejudice simply is not, by definition, judgment on the merits, and without a merits judgment, res judicata is not triggered.
Well, as I understand the situation, there were additional and different facts at the time of the second one in any event.
That is correct, Your Honor. And that would be an independent basis to reverse. That's true. So the res judicata argument is almost perfectly syllogistic in terms of the reversible error there. As to the treatment of the affidavit with regards to the custody request, the corroboration demand imposed by the district court is not present in the statute. It's not present in supporting case law. And to the extent that skepticism has any appeal, it should have been left for a later evidentiary hearing in substance by demanding additional corroboration beyond what was already present in the affidavit. The district court effectively was weighing the evidence in a way that it should not have at that early stage in the case.
Which of the, do you agree that under 257C01, to be an interested party, you were required to demonstrate one of the factors set forth in 03 sub 7?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And which of those, one or more, do you believe that the record sustains as a basis for determining that the grandparents are interested third parties?
All three factors, the first being abandonment, neglect, the second being the physical or emotional danger, and three, extraordinary circumstances. The strongest of those three factors is probably the second one, the physical or emotional danger. I would turn the panel's attention to addendum page 12 in appellant's brief, which is the supporting affidavit, and there the district court characterized the affidavit as lacking not just corroboration but detail, but in fact the affidavit is in the record and there's quite a bit of detail. It says that respondent Darcy Cross slammed JC, this is paragraph 10 on the page, slammed him against the basement wall, picked him up by his neck using both hands, wrapped around his throat, knelt on his chest, dragged him down the basement steps by his ankle. That's detail. And then two paragraphs later, in paragraph 12, we have the emotional abuse, the yelling, the excessively harsh punishments, stealing property, harassing friends, and the accusation there. So those allegations in the affidavit, those are probably the strongest ones for the factor under 257C03, subdivision 7, the emotional physical danger. The facts that support abandonment and neglect are also the same facts that go to extraordinary circumstances. As we detailed in our opening brief, a 14-year-old boy who had a safe home with his grandparents was nonetheless deposited at a Minneapolis homeless shelter in October when it was unlocked. And we're not seeking a bright-line rule of law that any use of a homeless shelter is necessarily extraordinary or is necessarily abandonment, but he was not, in fact, homeless. He had a home available to him, and at least at this early stage of putting forth some evidence to get to an evidentiary hearing, that's more than sufficient. I'm not saying that at such a hearing that alone would carry the day, but something is very unusual when you drop a boy off at a downtown homeless shelter instead of his grandparents, where there's no indicium that.
It seems like there's more facts than that, aren't there? That they were waiting for a bed to open for a treatment at a treatment facility. Is that questioned?
No, that is not disputed on this record at this point. And that waiting, seeking treatment for a son is not extraordinary. That's not neglect. That's not the problem. It's the use of a homeless shelter is the problem. So the district court's analysis somewhat treated them as the same, as though the use of a homeless shelter was therapeutic, but there's no evidence in the record that it was. So the wanting to seek treatment is fine, but using a homeless shelter when a home is available from a relative, that seems extraordinary. And in some literal sense, when a home's available and depositing a 14-year-old boy at a homeless shelter, that is a type of abandonment, physically.
And at the in June 11th of 2018, when the affidavit is signed, can you put that in temporally in context with the time spent at the homeless shelter?
To my knowledge, the time spent at the homeless shelter was relative. I don't have that on my fingertips, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
So, I mean, was it 6 months prior? Was it? I'm looking at the argument is a parent has abandoned, and this is in June of 2018. So at that point, the argument is, the assertion is that the parent has abandoned by virtue of placing the child. In other words, the child is currently abandoned. And I'm wondering, well, where is that abandonment at that point in time?
Well, it's
where was the child in June of 2018?
I don't believe in June of 2018. I'm not sure that the record reflects exactly where the child was. I'm sorry, Your Honor. The only thing I would add to my answer is that it's abandonment or neglect. So to the extent... to the extent abandonment has maybe a permanency that the court would be less likely to feel satisfied by a temporary use of a homeless shelter, neglect is sufficient under that subdivision 7.
In that very same affidavit, it looks like at paragraph 20, the affidavit says, I later learned from court documents that JKC was removed from the Bridge for Youth and placed in an institution in St. Cloud. Goes on and on, and then it says his current institutionalization is in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, which from the record, as I understand it, that would be an inpatient facility and not any sort of a transitional living arrangement at all.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. I think the timing of the movement from St. Cloud to Eau Claire is not clear from the record, but I want to be clear.
The district court is looking at it on the second action. The child is in an institutional facility in Eau Claire for a diagnosed, I don't think we really know exactly what the diagnosis is, but some sort of a inpatient treatment arrangement.
That's correct. So in some sense, the abandonment or neglect in terms of use of the homeless shelter was complete. It was no longer ongoing.
Which brings me back to, at the time that the second action is being decided by the district court, what factor evidences that the grandparents are interested third parties under subdivision 7? When the child's in a facility in Eau Claire receiving treatment, whatever happened before then, how are they interested parties under the statute?
Well, extraordinary circumstances from the prior use of the homeless shelter, as well as, I think, the ongoing risk of the physical and emotional danger. I don't know that the fact that prior physical and emotional abuse is demonstrated in the affidavit, and I don't know that it's not clear to me there's any authority that the fact that JC was at this point in a treatment means that the district court can ignore the past abuse. I'm not aware of any authority to that effect.
I mean, I think what I'm struggling with is there's a standard, clear and convincing evidence. I understand the argument, take the affidavit on its face. It's true for purposes of deciding that, but it's still a high standard, so there's a burden of production that needs to get you higher than just a preponderance. And when we look at these factors that the parent has abandoned or neglected such that the child will be harmed by living with the parent, I mean, we should finish the rest of that sentence. It's not just whether something that you happened in the past. And similarly, for number two, placement because of the presence of physical or emotional danger, and then it's relying on a 2015 and then undated over the years type paragraph. How is that enough to get to clear and convincing evidence that at present this child faces danger by being with the parents?
Allegations of the type of abuse here our clear and convincing evidence to show danger, the real risk or and actual abuse, the real risk of danger for this parent. I don't believe the statute contemplates a situation where the child, because the child is temporarily away from the abusive parent, that that means there is no physical or emotional danger. I don't read the statute that way. And even if the abandonment or neglect piece requires some sort of, as I think a fair reading statute would require, some sort of physical presence there, the physical and emotional danger are still real, even if the child isn't living with the abusive parent at the time. So long as the abusive parent has the right of custody So I don't read the statute as creating a safety valve or an escape or an exception where the child is physically not present in the home, at least as to the extraordinary circumstances prong, which is the third one, or the physical emotional danger. I think there's an argument there as to the first prong, perhaps.
As to the allegations of abuse, were they reported to the County Child Protection Department?
The County Child Protection was, a complaint was made to them, but I don't believe the record reflects that it was the exact same abuse as in paragraph 10 of the affidavit. And I think there is evidence in the record that the county chose not to intervene.
Made no finding of abuse.
Correct.
There's a December 22nd, 2017, which would be 6 months earlier, determination we did not find that abuse happened or services are needed. And that's about all it says. Was another report made after the entry to Eau Claire?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, not that this record reflects.
So there was allegations of abuse, investigation by Child Protection, finding of no abuse, temporary placement at a youth shelter while searching for a mental health or treatment facility, and now currently placement in a residential treatment facility. And no one's complaining about the appropriateness of that placement.
Well, I think that's fair, Your Honor, presently. As to that placement in Eau Claire, that is correct.
So you're saying the grandparents would continue that placement if they had custody?
Well, not necessarily. I think the affidavit and the record reflects that the grandparents don't have enough information to commit to that one way or the other at this point. Turning to the standing issue and visitation, the district court's mistake there was also relatively straightforward. The district court acknowledged that the plain language of the statute gave appellants standing, even said as much. But despite finding no ambiguity, the district court concluded that the legislature didn't intend this result despite the language, and that the legislature suggested that under subdivision 1, subdivision 5, or subdivision 6 of the same statute, different results might have been produced. Nonetheless, this issue should be disposed of by the Olson decision from the Minnesota Supreme Court, that if the language of the statute is plain, you simply apply it and you don't inquire into the policy or the subjective intent of the legislature, which is exactly what the district court did. At addendum page 4, the district court referred to, quote, the policy intended by the statute and common law principles, close quote, and it engaged with what its view of the policy was and what its view of common law principles were in lieu of the plain language of the statute, which does give these appellants standing.
The attorney's fee is, we don't have to address any attorney's fee issue.
Correct.
That's resolved.
Yeah, a special term panel decided because an order, or because judgment hadn't been entered on that order, it was not yet appealable.
Okay.
So unless the panel has any further questions, I'll sit down.
It appears we have none. You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal if you wish to use that time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Zachary Marsh on behalf of respondents Heather Cross and Darcy Cross. Now, the subject of this litigation is a now 16-year-old boy. It's undisputed. He has a myriad of issues. He's had chemical dependency issues. He's currently on inpatient treatment. And I have clients here who have done the best they can to protect this child. Getting back to Judge Rodenberg's question as far as timing, I think it's important to point out that this child at the time of the first petition was in inpatient treatment in St. Cloud, Minnesota.
Having been at this bridge program.
Correct.
For a short time.
For a short period of time, he was then placed in St. Cloud, Minnesota. And that was the status of this child at the time that the first petition was heard and dismissed. A subsequent petition was brought, and in the interim, the child had been transferred to this Eau Claire, Wisconsin. It was a better fit for this particular child's needs. So he's been in inpatient treatment during both of the pendencies of these petitions. My client pointed out in her affidavit that she believes this is rooted in conflict more between appellants and their daughter and son-in-law. And that is the primary reason that more information about the child's medical diagnoses and treatment has not been disclosed. There's simply an inability to communicate here. And my clients have that right. They don't need to produce that information. They don't need to provide grandparents with ongoing updates as to the status of this child. And, you know, that's unfortunate that this has happened in this family dynamic, but it shouldn't provide a basis for an intervention here and a request for either third-party custody or grandparent visitation.
Well, I don't think their argument is that you had to produce the information. Their argument is that given the information that they produced, they have standing under 257C03 sub 7.
I think that is certainly their argument. I think in addition,
how they got the standing isn't really the question. Do they have standing?
Mm-hmm. And to that, I think the answer is no. The district court analyzed the affidavits, the petition under the Lewis Miller Ross standard. They took a look at this, and I think the standard of review here is an important piece. I think the appellant's position is that this should be reviewed de novo because the affidavits are available. That is, I don't believe, quite accurate. It's a bit more nuanced than that. The Lewis Miller v. Ross case essentially led us down, gave us some framework that we are to follow Niece Peterson as well. This is essentially a custody modification request. And so we're looking at the first question, do the facts alleged in the affidavit, are they accepted by as true by the district court? Are they can they be contextualized? That is reviewed de novo. Moving past that, though, whether the facts alleged rise to or provide a prima facie basis to grant an evidentiary hearing, that is an abuse of discretion review. And that, I think, is where the main disagreement here lies. And so the district court thoroughly analyzed the facts under the applicable standard and came to the conclusion that on their face, the allegations just did not rise to the level necessary to proceed under Lewis Miller v. Ross. They did not use the term prima facie. I will certainly admit that. But I think the logic, the reasoning certainly tracks with both Lewis Miller as well as Niece Peterson in this case.
Do the grandparents have standing to seek visitation under 257C08 sub 2A?
The district court found no for two reasons. Again, there was the statutory analysis and there was some interpretation as far as whether...
Why was there interpretation? As I understand it, the issue is timing. And the statute says at any time after completion of the proceedings. Mm-hmm. There doesn't seem to be any time limit. So, you know, the divorce could have been 10 years ago. Grandparents could still come in.
And I agree with that. I think where the district court came down on this, they're looking at it as the divorce there was no nexus to the present action.
But does the statute require a nexus?
On its face, no. And I think what the district court found was that the result was unreasonable.
But the plain language doesn't require a nexus.
No, it doesn't.
And there was a dissolution.
Correct.
So it seems like the facts of this case at least fall within that statute in terms of requesting grandparent visitation as opposed to third-party custody.
The district court also went on to analyze under a second lens. First, the statutory interpretation. Second, they did say that even if the grandparents did have standing here, the facts alleged, it's clear on the undisputed facts that the granting of grandparent visitation would interfere with the parent-child relationship here. And there is no right to an evidentiary hearing on a grandparent visitation request. And so I think the court was within its discretion to dismiss this request based upon the facts presented in the context that they did.
I'm a little puzzled about that one, too. You're looking at paragraph 16 of the district court's findings and order, right? Where it says that it's undisputed that the petitioner's grandparents
yes.
made the decision to give him money, et cetera, while he's in an inpatient facility. Do we know what all of the facts are? It seems like those facts are significantly in dispute on this record.
I don't believe it's disputed that the grandparents had provided some financial assistance and I believe some clothing while the child was at the Bridge for Youth.
6 months earlier than the request in June. Right?
Correct.
What facts do we have in June about whether it would be good or bad or indifferent for the grandparents to have visitation with the child from June?
And as far as facts, I think the district court was relying on past actions to determine whether or not it was likely that would be an ongoing issue, ongoing interference with the parent-child relationship. I do want to turn back. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I'm just, so what would, so paragraph 16, when would a grandparent in this situation get to an evidentiary hearing? Does it have, I mean, do those need to be undisputed? You said there's no right to get to an evidentiary. I'm trying to figure that out and what the standard is that applies for the district court to decide it and then help us in our review of that.
Well, I don't know that there's, I think it's within the discretion of the district court to grant an evidentiary hearing. I think that's generally in most situations they have that authority. But there's no prior structure, no standard as in, for example, Niece Peterson or Lewis Miller v. Ross, where there's a procedure to get to that point. Mm-hmm. I think it's within the district court's discretion to handle visitation matters, just as they could handle a parenting time between two parents motion to modify without an evidentiary hearing. They can do so on the basis of affidavits. And in this case, the court didn't feel that it needed further information and that what it had was sufficient to deny the request.
So at that stage, it could even, based on the affidavits, resolve sort of conflicts or disputes between them? It could make factual determinations?
I believe so.
Okay.
If it's going to decide the grandparent, the non-parent visitation question, subdivision 4 obligates the court that the court shall consider the reasonable preference of the child, and I don't see a single thing in here about the reasonable preference of the child as of June at the time of the second proceeding. Can you show me anything that shows what the child's preference was in this record?
I don't believe that I can point to anything specific. I've not reviewed the medical records recently that may have indicated some preference, but I can't point to anything off the top of my head.
Well, if the district court didn't consider the child's preference, do you agree we'd have to remand?
I don't believe that it would be a required remand so long as it was clear that I don't believe the district court is required to make specific findings.
I agree with that. It doesn't say anything about findings, but it says the court shall consider the reasonable preference of the child. I don't think it has to make findings about it, but I can't tell from this record that it could possibly have considered that because I couldn't find anything in the record that would have allowed it to consider that.
Does subdivision 4, that's what we're looking at,
yes.
apply here? has the minor resided for two or more years? Has resided in a household with a person other than a foster parent for two or more years, et cetera.
Perhaps not.
I apologize. I'm trying to find the statute. I'm not able to get to it immediately. But if that is the case, then no, the child has not resided with anyone but the parents in this case.
Has a child resided with the grandparents under subdivision 3?
No.
Just wondering where the standard comes for a child who's never resided with anyone other than his parents, if that's the record. I don't know.
And again, I apologize. I don't have I can't seem to find the statute at my fingertips here, but I believe the standard we're dealing with is a bit more narrow when there's not been that period of time residing with either the grandparents or a third party. I believe what the district court is tasked with in a situation such as these is a determination as to whether the visitation request would be in the child's best interests, as well as whether that grant of visitation would interfere with the parent-child relationship.
Under sub 2.
Under yes.
So your argument on grandparent visitation is that even if the district court erred by concluding the grandparents did not have standing to request visitation, the error is harmless because the district court also made a finding that visitation would interfere with parent-child relationship, which would be a basis to preclude visitation under the statute.
That is accurate, yes.
There's no requirement of having a hearing on the visitation component as opposed to the safeguards for third-party custody hearings.
At least not an evidentiary hearing. In this case, there was a hearing on the record. The parties had the opportunity to submit facts,
affidavits.
Yeah, correct.
Argument.
And there was an affidavit. The record consists of an affidavit from the grandparents and an affidavit from mom?
From mom, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Anything else?
I did just want to make one note about the allegations of abuse. I just have a couple of minutes left here, and I know they've been discussed. And they certainly sound significant. Judge Renberg, you pointed out there was a December 2017 social services report that indicated no abuse based on whatever the investigation was that took place.
It didn't indicate no abuse. It indicated there was no finding of abuse.
Well,
we did not find that the abuse happened. They didn't find that the abuse did not happen.
Okay. I believe that is... Well, yeah, I think that's accurate. That is
not finding that a thing happened is different than finding that it didn't happen.
That's correct. The point I did want to make was that the allegations of abuse are based on a purported conversation between the minor child and the grandparents in the summer of 2015. That is over 2 years before a petition was brought requesting third-party custody or grandparent visitation. The allegations are also undated. We have no idea when this may have occurred, if it had occurred at all. And so they're certainly distant in time, and I don't know that there's a cutoff for these types of things, but they are, they're not recent. And there was very little that was done between the summer of 2015 and when the first petition for third-party custody was brought. And I think that's just an important thing to note here, that significant gap in time. And with that, I have a few seconds left. Are there any further questions? Otherwise, I have nothing further.
It seems we have none. Thank you.
Thank you.
The appellant has 5 minutes for rebuttal if the appellant wishes to use that time.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. A few points. First, on the standard of review regarding the interplay with Niece Peterson. The district court was clear on at least one issue with regards to standing in the custodies. It believed it was engaging in a standing analysis, not a prima facie case analysis. And not only do we know that because the district court didn't use the phrase prima facie case, but the district court also stated that it was engaged in a standing analysis. It used the word standing. And so
even if the petitioners did have standing.
Right. I mean, I think that, and now perhaps the district court shouldn't have, I mean, our contention is the district court erred by engaging in a standing analysis, and that's one more reason to reverse. But if the district court said it was doing something and did that thing, that's the standard of review to apply.
But what is the functional difference when the court says the issue is standing? In order to qualify, they have to be, in order to have it, they must qualify under this statute. The burden the petitioners must meet to survive a motion to dismiss. In other words, you look at, like, standing or surviving a motion to dismiss by establishing a prima facie case. I mean, what's the functional difference between the two here?
Well, my answer to that question is none, because a motion to dismiss is reviewed de novo, like standing is reviewed de novo. But under the Nies-Peters analysis, the sort of the second step, as to whether or not an evidentiary hearing should be held, that is reviewed for an abuse of discretion. I hope that answers your question, Judge Smith. So functionally, if we look at it through a motion to dismiss lens, it's the same. We have de novo review. But it would be different, this would be a different appeal if the district court had said, I conclude there is standing, but I'm now engaging in a discretionary decision looking at the affidavits to decline to hold an evidentiary hearing. That would be different, and the mistake the district court would make in that case would not be the same as this one.
And what was the mistake made here?
Concluding the grandparents didn't have standing when they did. So it's a legal mistake subject to de novo review.
And if we were to conclude the district court did not err on that standing question, the issues regarding the actual hearing that would have occurred if they had standing are immaterial.
Well, I think a remand is required for those issues.
A remand would be required if we concluded the district court erred. But what I'm saying is, if we were to conclude de novo that the district court correctly determined that the grandparents failed to establish a basis to seek custody under the statute, that is standing, that would be the end of it.
That is, yes, I'm sorry, Mr. That would be correct, Your Honor, yes.
And the child is now and has been in treatment programs where presumably the professionals who are working with the child are mandatory reporters who would be required to report to the government any allegations of abuse that the child made, even past allegations regarding his stepfather if he made those disclosures in treatment?
I'm not a Wisconsin lawyer, but I assume that Wisconsin
assume
has
the same
laws.
As Minnesota.
Yeah.
So there are safeguards.
I would assume as much. Which would, of course, go away as soon as he's released from his facility back to his abusive father. If the panel has no other questions, I would urge reversal.
I'm sorry. I do have one. With respect to paragraph 12 and the of the court's – oh, wait. Do I have the right paragraph? I guess I want to address the argument. You're asking for a remand for an evidentiary hearing. And the argument that we heard from opposing counsel is there's no need on a visitation issue because one can look at the record and it's abuse of discretion standard of review and a district court can make findings on that. What is our standard of review for it's paragraph 16, the court's findings with respect to the impact of a, you know, against the best interest and would result in conflict with parents. What's our standard of review for that, and why would we remand on that for an evidentiary hearing on that issue?
Well, the standard of review for a determination is whether a prima facie case had been made, assuming standing.
I'm on a visitation.
But on visitation.
Oh, excuse me, I'm sorry. Well, on visitation, here a remand is required even in the face of these findings because the errors that the district court committed on the other issue were a reason it didn't hold a hearing. So I think there is some intertwining here, both of the facts and the legal error. So at a bare minimum, I'd urge this court to remand simply for a hearing, just so the district court can make these findings on a full record instead of a narrow paper record.
Why do you think the district court would have held a hearing on the visitation question if that was the only question before it?
Well, at the time it made this, it might not have if that were the only question before it, but when it decided this order, both the custody issue and the visitation issues were both alive.
But I'm trying to understand why. Your argument seems to be we need to have a hearing on the visitation issue, even though whether or not to hold a hearing is discretionary, and the district court considered the information before it and made a decision that visitation would not be in the best interest of the child under the criteria set forth in the statute. And you seem to be saying that because of what the district court did on the third-party custody issue, it impacted its decision not to hold a hearing on the visitation issue.
As a practical matter, I think that's true, Your Honor. Since the light's red, I would say then that the district court abused its discretion on this record, as explained in paragraph 16 of its order. That would be my other answer. We urge reversal and remand. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We thank both counsel for your briefing and argument. The matter is submitted, and we'll issue our decision in a timely fashion as required by our rules. Thank you.